Side 6, Pearls of Lutra by Brian Jiggs. Continuing on page 252. Vasconza prodded the glaring lizard with his sword point.
Don't you fret, matey. You won't have to suffer such rough company as us much longer. We'll deliver you back to old Ublaz by nightfall one way or another. Eh, mates?
The corsairs and sea rats lying about the camp laughed uproariously at their leader's crude jest.
Do we deliver him back in a bit, or bit by bit? Haw, haw, haw.
Grewjaw was not interested in the banter.
When do we take back our ships?
He said, scowling at Vasconza. The fox smiled craftily.
When we're good and ready, mate. That's what Ublaz is expecting us to do, raid the jetty to get back our vessels.
Ha! Old Mad-Eyes would have a plan laid to stop that, never fear.
No, the palace is more important than the ships to us right now. We'll keep Ublaz hemmed in there until he's ready to parley.
Guja looked quizzically at Vasconza.
Then what?
The fox drew his favorite dagger and licked the blade slowly.
Then we plays him false and kills him. Pine martens ain't the only ones good at treachery, you know.
Grewjaw was still not happy.
But we need ships. What about our vessels? He said.
Vasconza thought about this for a moment. Then he stood and walked to the hilltop overlooking the cove. He pointed down at the vessel that had been scuttled there.
You want a ship, Grewjaw? See, there's Varanka's old craft, the freebooter. She's only been scuttled. I'll wager a good beast like yourself with a decent crew could seal her up, bail her out, and drag her ashore at low tide. Once the old freebooter is seaworthy again, there ain't a faster craft in all the seas.
Grewjaw took a crew down to the cove. When he had gone, Vasconza lay back and cracked the shell from his roasted lobster.
There. That should keep Grewjaw happy. Besides, we could do with having a ship afloat that Ublaz don't know about. It'll come in useful.
As night fell, Ublaz himself went down to the escarpment to view the body of the monitor that had been dumped there by Vasconza's crew. Surrounded by an armed guard of monitors and trident rats, the Pine Marten paid little attention to the dead lizard. He was more interested in the sailcloth that had been thrust into its mouth. Retrieving it, he stood to one side and read Rasconza's scrawl.
"We will talk together tomorrow. Ignore this, and I will burn you out. Hoist a green flag if you agree to meet me, midday in middle of island. Vasconza."
Ublaz motioned Sagatar away from the rest. Then he walked her out of earshot along the escarpment before whispering to her,
"Bring 6 good archers to my throne room before midnight. Let no beast see them, and speak of this to none."
Ublaz smiled to himself as he strode back to his palace. He was once more back in the game. The fox would soon know he could not outsmart an emperor. Waveworm had been free of the fog and ice for more than 2 days. She plowed on westward as the weather grew more clement. The sun shone, although the wind was still cold and the seas were rough. Abbot Durrell sat in the cabin of Romska, the ferret captain. He gnawed hard ship's biscuit and sipped at a beaker of none-too-clear water. Durrell's mind was anywhere but aboard a corsair vessel. Mentally, he was back at his beloved abbey, picturing himself pottering about in the orchard with his friend Rollo, or helping Teasel and Higgle with the baking. The old mouse wrinkled his nose, sniffing, and imagined laying a tray of hot scones, fresh from the oven, on a window ledge to cool. Smiling, he had a vision of several mischievous dibbins loitering near the scene, to see if they could liberate the odd scone. Durrell actually wagged a paw, warning them off.
Little rascals.
He was jerked back to reality by the sounds of steel upon steel and roars of conflict as paws stamped around the deck outside. Matters had finally reached a head. The fighting had begun. Either Romska had attacked Lask Frildor, or vice versa. Pushing a table in front of the cabin door, Durrell sought about for any other furniture that might block the entrance. Meanwhile, the sounds of battle grew outside on deck, accompanied by the occasional scream and splash as some beast went over the side. Pulling the grimy blanket from Romska's bunk, the abbot huddled in a corner. He wrapped himself tightly and sat miserably in the dim cabin, hoping that Romska would triumph over the hated monitor general. The sounds of fighting seemed to go on endlessly as day drew gradually to a close. Durrell closed his mind to everything, even thoughts of his own life or death. Eventually, he fell into a doze, his mind lulled into slumber by the vision of a mousemaid singing sweetly to him. High o'er the hills, far o'er the seas, fly with the small birds, follow the breeze. Go with your heart, where would you roam? Back to the rose-colored stones you call home, where faded summers will echo again, brown autumn trees, or the spring's gentle rain. Shadows are falling across woodlands, you know. Rest, weary one, in the warm firelight glow. It was fully dark when Abbot Durrell came gradually awake. Creaking ship's timbers and the endless wash of waves against the vessel's sides were the only sounds he could hear. The din of conflict had ceased altogether. Holding the musty blanket around him, the old mouse groped his way cautiously across the cabin floor. With no light to guide him, and the absence of his eyeglasses denying him clear sight, Durrell fumbled his way forward, until a table leg came into contact with his paw. At least the cabin door was still securely blocked, he thought. He sat with his back against the table, not knowing what to do next, longing for contact with some other living creature, providing that it was a friend. Dawn came gradually, cloaked by gray skies and soft, drizzling rain. It was warmer, though humid. Faint, gloomy light began pervading the cabin from a small, dirty window, too high for Durrell to reach. A sound caused him to become alert. Some beast was scratching at the cabin door from outside. Not knowing whether it would be friend or foe, but fearing the worst, Durrell crept back to his corner and sat waiting, watching the door. The scratching gave way to a thumping noise, faint at first, but growing heavier. The abbot of Redwall sat filled with apprehension as the door began to shake under the blows. Then suddenly there was a sharp, splintering crack, and a cutlass blade thrust its way through the rifted wood. Durrell watched fearfully as the blade was withdrawn, only to slash through again a moment later. Shrinking down into his blanket, he watched horrified as the blade hacked and sliced at the quivering timber, splintering the door in its onslaught. The old mouse could stand it no longer. "Who's there? Who is it?" he cried out. Crack! An entire panel burst, and the huge reptilian head of Lask Frildur was thrust through the broken aperture. 36. From the shelter of the little canvas tent on the ice floe, Viola was first to see the intruders. She gave a shriek of alarm, and instantly the sword was in Martin's paw. Shoving the canvas awning away from him, he came upright, ready to do battle. Klecki, who had clapped a paw across Viola's mouth, stared about in astonishment at the mass of creatures surrounding the logboat. Great seasons of salad! Where'd this mob of nautical nightmares come from, what? Snub-nosed, stiff-whiskered, and dark-eyed, the huge beasts crawled around, staring curiously at the little logboat and its occupants. Martin raised the sword threateningly to warn them off. Graf Longfletch moved cautiously to the warrior's side, murmuring, "Put up that sword, Martin. They're the seal folk. Don't make any sudden moves, or they'll bull us into the sea and drown us." Martin lowered his blade, keeping his eyes fixed on the seal folk. "What do we do next?" he whispered to Graf. The otter relinquished her bow and arrows to show she was unarmed. "Leave this to me. Seal folk used to visit the holt of my kin. They don't speak our language, but I can understand them a bit." Graf climbed from the logboat and approached the foremost seal. He was a great bull, dark gray in color, and mottled with heavy spots. The big beast watched Graf impassively, head held majestically high, round black eyes unblinking. Graf crouched upon the ice, taking care not to raise her head higher than the lead bull. Holding her paws out level, she clapped them gently together several times and said, "Fare you day, home." Immediately the seals around began making a sort of coughing, barking sound, and surprised that Graf could speak their language. As the big leader bull silenced them with a haughty glare, Martin joined Graf and murmured to her, "What did you say to the big fellow?"
"I gave him a greeting, fare you day, just like saying good morning. Then I called him Halm, but long like this, Halm. It means great leader or king. The longer you sound it, the greater your respect. Shh, he's going to say something."
The seal looked regally down his wide, flattish nose at them.
"This is Mahoyle, Amen Halm Flo."
He moved his head about in a wide circle, as if indicating the iceberg where they were standing. Graf held up her chin and closed both eyes as she answered,
"Halm Flo Jan."
It seemed to satisfy the leader. He raised a massive flipper and slapped it loud and wetly once upon his sleek chest. Graf explained,
"I can't understand it all, but best as I can make out," he said, "this is my island. I am king of this ice floe." All I could think of to answer was to tell him he was a mighty king, and this surely was his floe.
"Do you know how to say not mine?" Martin asked Graf swiftly. Graf thought for a moment.
You just say, "Amino," I think.
Martin stepped forward, aware of the vast number of seals watching him. He spread his paws and brought them together, clapping softly as he had seen Graf do. Then he slapped one paw hard on his chest, as the Seal King had done.
"Halm Martin. Amino Flo. Amino,"
Martin said. This seemed to amuse the king greatly. He pointed a powerful flipper at Martin and said,
"Amino. Amino."
The seals fell about, rolling on the ice, slapping their flippers loudly and emitting great barking merriment. The great bull seal towered above Martin. Raising his flipper high, he brought it down gently on the mouse warrior's head and patted him.
"Halm, Martin. Halm,"
he rumbled. This caused even greater jollity among the seal folk. They shook their heads and blinked rapidly as they honked with laughter. Klecky climbed out of the logboat to join Martin and Grat.
"I say, good thing. These wallas have a sense of humor, what?"
The hare slithered boldly over the watery ice to face the king. Straightening his long ears, Klecky brought them together several times, as if clapping. Pursing his lips comically, he mimicked a seal.
"Home, old chap, home."
"How's that?" This time the hilarity was unbridled. Even the king rolled his gargantuan bulk over and over, tears streaming from his round dark eyes, as he held both flippers to his sides, shaking helplessly with laughter. This drove the hare on to further efforts. Lying stomach down and holding himself up with his front paws, Klecky looked majestically down his nose, bobbed his stubby tail about, and let one ear flap down hard across his brow. Then, in a perfect imitation of the seal king, he called out,
"Home, Klecky. That's me, chaps. Home, Klecky."
Some of these seals were laughing so hard they fell off the iceberg into the sea. Martin pulled Klecky upright.
"You'd better pack it in now. We don't want to be held responsible for any of these creatures laughing themselves to death. Especially the great Halm there. He looks fit to burst."
It took quite a while for the laughter to subside, but it had worked wonders. Some of the little seal pups slid out of the pack and nuzzled up against Klecky. The king pointed a flipper at Graf and looked questioningly at the other seals as he barked out a single word,
"Whalum."
There was a moment's silence. Then every seal began waving a flipper towards the otter and echoing the word,
"Whalum, whalum."
Graf was mystified. She looked at Martin and shrugged.
"I don't know what they mean."
Further discussion was cut short, as the friends found themselves lifted up bodily by the seals and tossed back into the logboat. Knowing the seal folk meant them no harm, They sat in silence, watching the procedure. With a mighty smack from his flipper, the king broke the stake holding the headline of the logboat. Other seals came flapping up with cables made from thick rubbery seaweed. These they proceeded to attach to the vessel from stem to stern until the little craft was festooned with woven seaweed ropes. Half a dozen stout young seals slid the logboat off into the water. Viola looked over the side. All the seaweed fastenings were held in the jaws of at least three seals to a cable. The king alone held the head rope in his teeth. He let out a sharp bark. Gitara! The logboat's crew fell over backward as the craft sped off into the fog, sending up a great bow wave. Flog and Welko scrambled up to the forward bowsprit. They watched, fascinated, as the sleek forms of the seal pack sped their boat through the seas at a breathtaking rate. Klecki settled back, winking at Viola.
Just the ticket, Miguel. Beat sailin' and rowin', what?
Absolutely top hole. Hope these chaps know where they're jolly well goin'. Graf blinked spray from her eyes as they shot out free of the clinging fog banks.
Oh, they seem to know where they're bound, all right. Ah, 'tis good to see clear day and sunlight again, though.
Martin agreed wholeheartedly.
It certainly is, friend.
Well, at least we're out of trouble with icebergs, and I'm sure the seal folk mean us no harm. Only problem is they don't know where we want to go, and we don't know where they're taking us.
Klecki began rummaging about in the remainder of their supplies.
Well, wherever we're jolly well going, I ain't traveling on a bally empty tummy. Let's see what the tuck situation is, what?
Eek! Look, look!
Viola was pointing out to sea. All eyes followed her paw. Martin could not believe his eyes.
Well, what are they?
Grath had seen them once before in her lifetime. She took a deep breath.
On the far north coast, where I was reared, we saw those sea creatures once. It was spring, and they swam almost up to the beach. My mother said they were called whales, and no creature in all the seas is as big as them. They blow water out of their heads, straight up, like a big fountain. Their tails are like the spread of two large oaks. See?
They stared, stunned by the size of the creatures. One of the whales raised a mighty fluke and slammed it down on the face of the ocean, causing an enormous white explosion of water. Martin watched the leviathans of the deep as they sported and played, each one like a black island rearing from the main.
Great seasons! I could imagine old Rollo laughing at me if I told him I had seen fishes as big as Redwall Abbey.
Plog and Welko were inclined to agree.
Ha! The Gwasim'd say we'd been asleep and seen the whales in our dreams, or they might say we'd eaten too much of Klecki's cooking.
The hare looked up, his face smudged from blowing on the ashes of the fire to get it rekindled again.
Oh, they would they? Base ingratitude. I've a jolly good mind to let you chaps get the scoff ready for that. I say, how about asking old Halmface to steer over that way, so's we can catch one of those whale-type chaps? I wonder what they taste like cooked up.
You'd need a blinkin' big pan.
Yach!
The hare shook himself as the rest of the crew shot water at him with their paws. He twisted his ears to wring them out.
Ya boo rotters! They've gone and put me flippin' fire out.
Toward evening the weather started to become mild and warm, though they were still feeling the breeze, owing to the fact that the tireless seal folk never once slackened their breakneck pace. The logboat hissed through the water, bouncing across the waves like a runaway arrow. Then Martin became worried.
See, the sun is setting in the west over that way. We're being taken northward.
Klecki had finally managed a small fire. He passed them each a slice of toasted shrewbread and some warm oat and barley cordial.
Nothing we can do about it at the moment, old lad. They're obviously taking us someplace, though. Let's wait until we get there and figure out our next move from where we land, what?
Grath stared out across the uncharted seas.
Aye, like as not, the fates'll send us where they want.
On the western horizon the sun dipped beneath the sea like a crimson fireball, shooting rays of scarlet, pink, and gold onto the underbellies of purple and cream cloud banks. Viola snuggled down in the stern, nibbling a crust of shrewbread,
and thinking how different it all was from sitting in Great Hall and dining off the sumptuous fare commonplace to Redwall Abbey, far from the lonely sound of waves upon open sea. 37. A full summer moon shone down on the path to Ninian's, casting pale, flickering shadows upon three grim-faced creatures pounding through the woods purposefully, at the head of a mixed band of shrews and otters, each one armed with sling, javelin, rapier, or bow and arrows. Bravely, Skipper kept pace with Logalog and Rangapaw, bearing his injuries stoically. From between the trees they glimpsed the half-ruined spire of the ancient building. Logalog gritted his teeth, clasping his shrew rapier tight. "Soon be there now," he said.
"Friend, is that you?"
Momentarily they halted and looked around. Again the voice sounded out into the night.
"I'm in the ditch, friends. Help me."
Throwing themselves flat at the path side, Skipper and his burly daughter delved through nettles and reeds that grew up the bank.
"Got him. Get the other paw.
Up you come, Rollo, sir."
His face smeared with mud and his garments rent and torn, the old recorder was hauled swiftly up onto the path, where he sat gasping out his story.
"We were attacked, or I should say the young maids were. It was jackdaws, a whole colony of the wicked birds. Geralt heard them screaming when we arrived at Ninian's. They were inside. Geralt told me to stay outside and charged in. There were awful sounds, screaming and cawing. Next thing I knew, Tansy and Cracklin were flung out through the door by Geralt, and he shouted for them to bring help from Redwall. So they could travel fast, they lowered me into the ditch, telling me to hide and keep out of harm's way. I don't know what happened after that, until I heard one of you speak as you ran by."
Logalog saw that Skipper was breathless, and his wounds were bothering him. The shrew chieftain sat the otter down on the path next to Rollo. "Stay here and guard him, Skip. You'll only slow us up. We've got enough here to do the job, me and this big'un of yours." The skipper of otters nodded. He understood.
"If our friends are hurt, then give those birds blood and vinegar. Go on, mate, get going."
Without a backward glance, they charged through the rotting doorframe of Ninian's. Jackdaws scattered everywhere as they tried to escape from the warriors who teamed in, roaring the abbey battle call, "Redwall!" Scruvo, their thieving leader, and another of his band, had Geralt on the floor, tearing savagely at him with their wicked beaks. Rangapaw hit Scruvo across the head with her otter javelin, the force of the blow shattering the weapon's haft and slaying Scruvo instantly. The other jackdaw gurgled its life out at the thrusting point of Logalog's rapier. Other birds fell to the deadly nemesis of otters and shrews, though some of them fled, winging off into the night, never again to be seen in Mossflower. Skipper and Rollo hobbled up to the gate in front of Ninian's. Logalog and several other shrews were binding Geralt with strips from their tunics and ditch mud mixed with herbs to staunch his dreadful injuries. Skipper hastened to his friend's side. He stared down at the owl's homely face.
"Is he alive?"
Logalog shrugged, totally at a loss.
"Aye, mate. There's still life in this owl. Though why that should be, I don't know. The bird's taken enough to kill any three of us. I counted 4 jackdaws in there that he'd slain. I've seen some tough ones in my seasons, but none like your mate Geralt."
A heart-rending cry, like that of a dying beast, escaped Rollo's lips. Rangapaw strode slowly out of Ninian's, carrying a forlorn little bundle in her hefty paws. Logalog held Rollo back as he tried to intercept the big otter. The old recorder's body was racked by sobs.
"No, no, not Picnum, my little friend. Say she lives, please."
Tears rolled openly down the sturdy face of Rangapaw. She clasped the limp form to her, as if nursing a babe.
"Poor young maid. She'll always live in the memories of her mates."
As Rangapaw walked off toward Redwall with her sad burden, Rollo tore free of Logalog's grasp. Straightening himself up, he wiped his eyes upon his habit sleeves and turned to the other chieftain.
"Skipper, will you help me to do something?" he said.
The otter grasped Rollo's frail old paw.
Anything, matey. Just ask. Rollo pointed to the doorway. Go in there and find a large pink pearl. It will probably be in the nest of the leader of those birds. Skipper was not long gone. As he emerged, everyone held their breath. He opened his paw to reveal the fourth pearl nestling in his palm. He handed it to Rollo, who clasped it tightly. Now, I want you to put flame to this place and burn it down. Skipper's voice registered his incredulity at the proposal. Burn it down? But there was no hesitation in Rollo's determined mood. I burn it down until it is just a heap of rubble and bad memories. This has become a place of evil. I have read in the Abbey records that on two occasions the enemies of Redwall used this place as a refuge. The first was Cluny the Scourge, in the time of Matthias the Warrior. Then there was Slagar the Cruel, in the time of Matameo, when I was but a Dibbon. Now it has been used a third time, as a den of thieves and murderers. Burn it! Dawn the next morning was gentle and bright. A silence seemed to lie over Mossflower Country, even the birds remaining mute. Goodwife Teasel and the badger mother Alma stood together on the ramparts of the outer wall, facing south. From where the path curved, they could see a dark column of smoke rising above the tops of the woodland trees. Alma nodded toward it. Skipper and his crew are still down there, seeing that it burns to the ground and the fire doesn't spread. Will you pack some food for them, Teasel? I'll take it down myself. The hogwife patted her friend's paw. I'll pack plenty. Knowing what good appetites yon otters have, though at the moment I detest to look at victuals or prepare 'em. Friar Eagle, bless him, he sent me off from the kitchens, and stayed to fix breakfast for any beast as wants some, but none came. The hogwife threw her flowery apron up over her face and wept. The poor little maid! To end up like that! And she was so young, too! I ain't no warrior, marm, but I hopes those wicked birds got all they deserved off Logalog and Skipper's big gell. Alma stroked her friend's headspike soothingly. There, there, don't take on so. Those birds paid dear for their evil ways. Logalog told me all about it last night. 'Twill be many a long season before we hear the call of a jackdaw in our land again, I promise you. The grief at Picknam's death was so great in Redwall Abbey that Alma had to assume the mantle of abbess and request that none came to the burying, because it would be far too upsetting for young and old. Accordingly, at midday, she and Rangipaw laid the young mousemaid to rest themselves. They chose a shady spot in the orchard, to one side beneath a great sweet chestnut tree, where they held a simple ceremony. Small gifts of remembrance from every Redwaller were placed in the grave. When the task was done, both Abbey bells tolled slowly, their clappers muted with velvet to soften the tone. Cracklin, Tansy, and Rollo stood at an upper window overlooking the orchard, despite the protest of Sister Cicely regarding their condition. The otter Glenner supported Cracklin as she stood at the window and sang. Her sweet voice, which had sounded out in harmony with Picknam's many times before, was now alone. It echoed beautifully off the outer walls until it seemed to fill the entire abbey and its grounds. Fare you well upon your journey to the bright lands far away, where beside the peaceful rivers you may linger any day. In the forests warm at noontide, see the flowers bloom in the glades. Meet the friends who've gone before you to the calm of quiet shades. There you'll wait, O my beloved, never knowing want or care, and when I have seen my seasons, we will walk together there. Glenner and Sister Cicely walked the three friends back to the room they were sharing at the infirmary. There they lay upon their beds, all with their own deep personal thoughts. Tea time passed, and still they had not stirred. Tansy lay on top of her counterpane, fully dressed, watching the sunlight lengthening afternoon shadows through the window. The door creaked open, and Friar Higgle Stump crept in, bearing a tray laden with slices of nut bread
a hot mushroom and leek pasty and gravy, a bowl of fresh fruit salad, and a flagon of his brother Furlough's best dandelion and burdock cordial. He wiggled his nose at them.
"Good afternoon, friends. I couldn't bear the thought of you up here being fed warm nettle broth. That shouldn't happen to any beast. So I brought up a little summit to tickle your appetites."
He placed the tray down, but they did not even look at it. The friar shook his head sadly.
"Deary me. Now if Miss Picknam were about, she'd have beat you all to it and gobbled everything up."
Cracklin sat up, shaking her head.
"No, she wouldn't. Picknam would have shared it with us, 'cause we're her friends. I mean, we were her friends."
Rollo sat up also, arching his eyebrows indignantly.
"Were? You mean we're not still Picknam's friends?"
Then Tansy sat up, glaring at Rollo.
"Cracklin never meant that. We'll always be Picknam's friends, her dearest and best, most treasured friends, so there."
A smile played around Friar Higgle's face.
"I knows how you can be such good friends with Picknam that no beast'd believe it."
Cracklin and Tansy spoke in unison.
"How?"
The friar perched upon the windowsill, his face serious.
"Just carry on like you're doing now, and don't eat no more. You'll soon be reunited with your friend by starving to death."
He winked broadly at Rollo, knowing the recorder would recognize the wisdom in his words. Rollo did. He sat up, filled himself a beaker, and chose a thick slice of nut bread. Then, eating and drinking, he began to speak.
"I vote we carry on searching for the tears of all oceans. Now, you maids keep silent. Just eat and listen to me. Eat!"
The old recorder's voice was sharp and commanding. Neither Tansy or Cracklin had ever heard him speak like that. Seating themselves close to the tray, they began eating. Rollo tossed the fourth pearl in the air and caught it.
"See this thing? Picknam gave her life for it. Between us, we vowed to find those six pearls, because they may be needed to ransom our abbot back from the enemy. I don't know about you two, but Rollo Bankvoll never breaks his word. I intend to find the other two pearls." "Pshaw! I'll wager Picknam would have had a very low opinion of us had she seen us a moment ago, moping and moaning with no thought of carrying on the very quest that she died for. Is that the act of friends?"
Tansy slammed her paw down on the tray so hard that she broke the bread platter.
"We'll find those pearls together, all three of us."
Cracklin whirled her bushy tail fiercely.
"Aye. And when we do, we'll stuff 'em down the throats of those scum who kidnapped our friends, one by one."
Friar Higgle crept smiling from the infirmary, murmuring,
"Very nice talk for young abbey maids. Charming. Enjoy your tea."
38. Tansy split the acorn shell that held the scrap of parchment. Unfolding it, she read aloud.
"There is a warrior. Where is a sword? Peace did he bring, the fighting lord. Shed for him is my fifth tear. Find it in the title here, written in but a single word. An eye is an eye, until it is heard."
Tansy paused, shaking her head in despair.
"Written separate to the rhyme is a pile of numbers, which don't seem to make any sense at all. Listen to this. Lines. One of one, 8 of 2, 1 of 3, 3 of 4, 1 of 5, 6 of 6, 2 of 7, 4 of 8.
She tossed the scrap of parchment to Cracklin.
"There you are, friend. Sort that little lot out."
Chewing slowly on a wedge of pasty, the squirrel maid narrowed her eyes, glaring a challenge at Tansy.
"Do you think I can't?"
Rollo peered over the tops of his glasses at her.
"We have great faith in you."
Cracklin took a great swig of her dandelion and burdock cordial.
"Then you're both a pair of dimwits, 'cause I haven't the faintest clue what it all means."
The three friends sat staring at one another for a moment, then broke out into spontaneous laughter. Rollo dug his spoon into the fresh fruit salad.
"If we're a pair of dimwits, then that makes you a blockhead. So among the three of us, we'll solve it. Ha, ha, ha."
The skipper of Otters was on his way upstairs to the infirmary when he met Sister Cicely coming down. Waving his rudder-like tail politely at her, he said, "Good noon to you, marm. I was just on my way up to see Garrel. How is he today? Probably still sleeping his injuries off, I wager." The good sister glared frostily at the husky otter. "Humph," she replied. Ever the gentle beast, Skipper nodded courteously at the sister. "Humph, marm? I suppose there's a wealth of meaning in the word, but it don't tell me naught about old Garrel. The poor bird was so badly wounded he was at death's doorstep last night. Pray tell, what's his condition today, marm?" Cicely was in no end of a huff.
That owl. He rose not an hour ago, refused all treatment, and hurled a pot of my best warm nettle soup from the infirmary window. You want to know his condition? Go and find out for yourself, sir. He's down in the kitchens, surrounded by otters, shrews, and dibbons, cooking and eating everything in sight.
Brushing Skipper aside, Sister Cicely flounced downstairs. Friar Higgle and Hogwife Teasel had dismissed the kitchen roster for the day, leaving the place open to any beast wanting to drop by and prepare something. Garrel and his friends had taken Higgle and Teasel at their word, and now chaos reigned in Redwall Abbey kitchens. Garrel and Arvin were demolishing a huge fruitcake between them, whilst issuing orders to Rangapaw, Diggum, and some shrews.
"Ah, now, don't be stingy. Throw in a few more pawfuls of those lovely candied chestnuts, and you need far more meadow cream than that if you're to make a decent sweet owl junket. As me old mother used to say, plenty more's better'n plenty less, if you're cooking for more'n a few. Ain't that right, Arvin, me little mate?"
The squirrel babe was sure it was. Waving a ladle at the cooks, he issued orders like one born to command.
"Gera more chestnuts and a big bucket of cream. A hooge big un. And throw some strawbees in. Arvin likes strawbees."
Then he turned to his owl friend with a serious frown.
"Your mother must have been good and clever."
Garrel dipped his talon in a pot of plum jam and sucked on it.
"Ah, sure, she was so clever she used to ask herself questions, so she did. It's no good knowing what you know if you can't ask your own advice," she always said. "Logalog, how's that shrew concoction coming along?"
The shrew chieftain looked up irately from a steaming pan he was stirring.
"The vegetables are doing nicely, but every time we get the pastry rolled out, those moles keep pinching it. Get out of it, rogues!"
He threw a wet dishcloth at Gerbul and several other young moles who were shuffling off with his latest batch of pastry. Formole blinked quizzically at them over the top of a special deeper never pie he was creating.
"Her, what do we want all em pastry fur, Gadgy?"
The mole babe Gadgy poked his snout out from under a floppy layer of pastry he was carrying.
"For making honey moles, zir."
Skipper joined the little moles as they kneaded dough on a countertop, busy as bees and covered in flour.
"Ahoy, mates, what's an honey mole?" he asked.
Gerbul crossed his digging claws on his stomach, tut-tutting at the otter's ignorance.
"Chut, chut, zir. You don't know what a honey mole is? Look an oil showy. You pay attention now."
The mole babe rolled out a small patch of pastry, spread it thick with honey, and placed on it a strawberry and a raspberry. Wrapping the pastry carefully over the fruit, he coated the lot with a mixture of honey and damson juice. It looked nothing like a honeyed mole, but the mole babes thought it did.
Gerbul licked his digging claws proudly and added his honey mole to several others on a tray, ready to go in the oven.
He wrinkled his nose proudly at Skipper.
"Her, that'n be how to make honey moles, zir."
Skipper winked broadly at the mole babe.
"Thanks, matey, I'll remember that. Should come in useful."
Then, opening a cupboard, he took out a bag of dried water shrimp. Glenner sidled up with an expectant gleam in her eye.
"Shrimp and hot root soup, Skip?"
The otter chieftain showed his white teeth in a mock villainous grin.
"Aye, matey, you go get the ot root. Oh, and some onions. Ahoy, Rangapaw, where do they hide the mushrooms in this galley? And leeks, too. We'll need lots of leeks. Aye, and white turnips."
Garrel, meanwhile, had finished the last of the fruitcake, and now he and Arvin set about making another,
even bigger one. "Come on now, you young rip, a tankard of October ale, flour and honey. What's next?" asked the owl. Arvin counted off the ingredients on his paws. "Plums, damsons, hazelnuts, chestnuts, blackberries,
Garrel limped off to the pantry, chuntering to himself. "Sure we'll toss in a bit of everything, as me old mother used to say. If you've got everything in the cake, then you're sure to have left nothing out, providing it's all in."
Sister Cicely had brought Alma down to the kitchens. She pointed a paw of condemnation at the shambles.
"Just look at that. Did ever you see such a mess in your life?"
The badger mother wandered over to where the mole babes had left their tray of honey moles to cool, and popped one in her mouth.
Very tasty. Cicely, let them have their fun. Have we not had enough sadness and misery in Redwall for one day? This bit of disturbance is easily cleared up, but it helps them to recover their spirits, especially the young ones. I look on this not as mourning the death of Picknam, but celebrating the happy life she led. Come now, sister, leave them to their enjoyment.
Tansy, Cracklin, and Rollo had deserted the confines of the infirmary. The early evening was soft and balmy, and it was far nicer out in the fresh air than lying about indoors and being fussed over by Sister Cicely. They sat on the gatehouse steps, staring at the rhyme and the puzzle that went with it. But the clue to the fifth pearl remained a mystery to them. "Perhaps if we concentrate on the rhyme, it may help." Cracklin shook her head at Tansy's suggestion. "No, I'm sure the key is in these figures. Once we know what they refer to, I have a feeling the rest will be easy."
Rollo polished his glasses and scrutinized the figures closely. "Hmm. I have a feeling you're right, miss. Let's concentrate all our attention on these figures for the moment. Lines. 1 of 1. 8 of 2. 1 of 3. We'll take that bit first."
All three gazed at the parchment scrap, cudgeling their brains for inspiration. Wulger, the otter gatehouse keeper, was in the process of cleaning out his small domain. He opened the gatehouse door wide and began sweeping about with a heather-topped broom. So pleasant was the aroma of the heather that he took his own good time, brushing diligently in every corner and singing a song as he went about his chore. "There was an otter by a stream, come ringle-dum, o' lady, who fell asleep and had a dream, all on the bank so shady. He dreamt the stream was made of wine, it flowed along so merry, and when he drank it tasted fine, like plum and elderberry. And all the banks were made of cake, come ringle-ding, my deary, as nice as any cook could bake. That otter felt quite cheery. He drank and ate with right good will, till wakened by his daughter. She said, 'I hope you've had your fill of mud and cold stream-water. Come ringle-do-fall-doodle-day. Come wise beast or come witty, a fool who dreams to dine that way must waken to self-pity.'" The three friends on the wall steps outside heard Wulger's song clearly. They shook their heads and chuckled. As Wulger emerged, sweeping dust in front of him, Cracklin called down, "That's a good ditty. I've never heard it before." The old otter smiled up at the squirrel maid. "I'm glad you liked it, missy. 'Tis a song that's been passed down through my family. If you like, I'll teach you the lines."
Tansy leapt up, yelling, "The lines! It's the lines!"
Wulger stared in amazement at the three creatures, dancing paw in paw on the wall steps, as they chanted together,
"The lines! The lines! It's the lines!"
He shrugged and went indoors to continue his cleaning.
"Maybe when you're not so busy dancing and chanting, I'll learn you the song."
Tansy scanned the poem's first line. "There is a warrior. That's line one, so 1 of 1 must mean the first word, or the first letter of the line. What do you think, Rollo? The first word or the first letter?" The recorder was quite definite which it was. "It has to be the letter, 1 of 1, because the second clue states 8 of 2. But there's only 4 words in the second line, so we're looking for enough letters to make a word."
Tansy read out the lines.
Cracklin counted the letters, and Rollo scraped each letter upon the sandstone step with his quill knife. There is a warrior, one of line one, letter T. Where is a sword, eight of line two, letter A. Peace did he bring, one of line three, letter P. The fighting lord, three of line four, letter E. Shed for him is my fifth tear, one of line five, letter S. Find it in the title here, six of line six, letter T. Written in but a single word, two of line seven, letter R. An I is an I until it is heard, four of line eight, letter Y. The friend sat but for a brief moment, looking at the word Rollo had scratched upon the step. Then Cracklin and Tansy dashed off towards the abbey, with Rollo hobbling behind as they yelled, "The tapestry!" 39. Sagittar did as she was bidden. Late night lay still and heavy from the day's tropical heat when she arrived at the Emperor's throne room. Six trident rats accompanied her, each one armed with a bow and quiver of shafts. Ublaz awaited them, clad regally in an umber robe, bordered with silver filigree work, and wearing a turban of dark green with silver fringes. At the center of the room, a small wooden log stood on its end. Ublaz directed the archers, one to each corner of the vast room, one by the window and one by the door. Moving himself and Sagittar out of the line of fire, he instructed the archers, "I have raised my paw thus. When I drop it, you will shoot at the log. I want to see six arrows sticking from the log. Arm your bows and await my signal." There was a swift rattle of wood as the rats set shafts to their bowstrings. Ublaz saw they were ready. He dropped his paw. Thunk! Six arrows thudded into the log before it fell, propped up by two of the shafts. The Emperor's mad eyes creased into a smile. "Excellent! Sagittar will show you your positions. Be watchful and stay well hidden. Tomorrow you will see me meeting with the fox Rasconza. As I move towards him, I will hold up my paw in greeting. When I let it drop, I will also fall flat to the ground. That is your signal to shoot the arrows. I need not tell you that all six shafts must find their mark, or none of you will be alive to see the sunset. Finish the task properly, and you will all be well rewarded. Go now." Bowing low, the archers followed Sagittar out. Down in the small cellar chamber, Ublaz donned his crown with its six pearl spaces still empty. He held the torch level, watching as the coral snake slithered sinuously out of its water trough, glimmering gold in the torchlight. Gliding effortlessly across the floor, it reared dangerously in front of him, mouth open and fangs bared, beady eyes focused on him as he started to sway and chant in dirge-like tones. "Golden guardian of my wealth, hear me now, be still. Deathly fang and coiling stealth, bend unto my will." The snake hissed, its dark flickering tongue vibrating, as it drew back to strike. The eyes of Ublaz grew wider as he kept up his steady chant, swaying, swaying. Then the snake began to move in unison with Ublaz, weaving smoothly to and fro as he swayed. Gradually the pine marten exercised his power over the serpent. It sank down into bunched coils, both eyes filming over. The venomous mouth relaxed and closed. Ublaz stroked the snake's head once, then turned and departed the room. The two guards on the door could hear his voice echoing back down the stairway as he made his way back to the throne room. "None can stand against Ublaz. My eyes conquer all. My will is stronger than that of any living thing. I rule, others obey." Midday sun burned like a great blazing eye upon the shallow valley in the center of San Petra. On the ridge of a rolling hill, sea rats and corsairs crowded, watching the lone figure of Rasconza standing bold and unarmed, awaiting the arrival of his adversary. Atop the opposite hill, a regiment of trident rats was marshaled. Ublaz left his position at their center and made his way down towards the fox. Wisely, Rasconza kept his eyes averted slightly to one side as the pine marten approached. Less than a dozen paces from Rasconza, Ublaz threw up his paw and called out in a voice laden with false cheer,
"Ah, Rasconza, there you are, friend! Greetings!"
Now Ublaz was less than 4 paces away. He fell to the ground, silence. Looking up, he saw Rasconza, eyes still averted, chuckling.
"You got to watch your step round here, matey," said the fox. "'Tis dangerous ground. Only last night, 6 rats tripped and fell on their arrows. But they could be pardoned for being clumsy, 'cause it was still dark."
Ublaz leapt up and was dashing back towards his regiment as Rasconza waved to the sea vermin and roared, "Charge!" They poured down from the hill, cheering and shouting as they brandished a fearsome assortment of weaponry. Surrounded by his trident rats, Ublaz fled back to the palace in shameless disorder. Robbed of his surprise plan, the pine marten was seething with rage. He broke clear and dashed ahead of his regiment's panicked retreat. Far speedier than any of the trident rats, Ublaz raced on with one thought uppermost in his mind. Had Rasconza secretly sent a force round and a wide sweep to gain control of the palace? He had left it with only Sagittar and the remaining monitors to guard it. The first wild rush of the wave brethren subsided to a steady lope, as, still yelling blood-curdling cries, they continued in Ublaz's wake. Rasconza jogged along in their midst, a villainous smile fixed on his wily face, as he called out to Grewjaw and Buckler,
"Ha-ha! Look at 'em go, like frightened chicks with an eagle on their tails. Run, Mad-Eyes, run, you swab!"
The steer's rat Guja, who had not been privy to his leader's plans, looked questioningly over at the fox.
"But, Captain, why aren't we charging faster? We could have beaten them in an open battle with our numbers."
Rasconza winked craftily and chuckled.
"Aye, mayhap we would, matey. But it would have been a great slaughter, and who knows how many of us would have fallen to those long tridents. My way's better, Guja. Now we'll have the mighty Emperor just where we want him. Outsmarted and isolated."
Ublaz was astounded to find his palace unharmed. Monitors held open the gates as he hurtled in ahead of his paw-sore followers. Straight through to the throne room he hastened, to find Sagittar and a monitor called Flygard surveying the harbor from the window. The fine marten slowed, regulating his breath, allowing himself a brief smile of relief. So the sea scum did not attempt any attack here. How foolish of Rasconza, he might have taken this place in my absence. Sagittar pointed down to the deserted jetty. "Sire, after you left, a small force of them sailed in to the jetty, aboard the vessel Freebooter. They have made it seaworthy again. They towed away all the ships that were docked there, from right under our noses. Lord, they laughed at us and waved their swords in the air. It was as if they knew that we could not desert the palace and go outside to do battle with them." Ublaz dismissed the monitor with a nod, then poured wine for Sagittar. His mind was forming a plan, even as the wine gurgled into the 2 goblets. Sagittar looked slightly bemused that her master was not angry. He gazed at the empty harbor and nodded.
"The fox has won a battle, but I will win the war. Come."
Rasconza and his vermin stood on the rocks, a safe distance away from the rear of the palace. Guja, the steer's rat, perched on top of a rocky outcrop, his keen eyes watching the high back wall of the building. Then Rasconza addressed his captains and their crews.
"Old Mad-Eyes is trapped like a rat in his own cage now, buckos. He ain't got nowheres to go. We got the ships, so we rule the seas. We got the island, too. Looks like we're in charge as long as Ublaz is bottled up in there. Any signs of movement, Guja?"
Shielding his eyes, the steer's rat peered toward the wall.
"Nah. Wait. Aye, there he is, old Mad-Eyes himself, and the rat Sagittar, too, if I ain't mistaken. Ah, Sagittar's got a bow and arrow. Look out, she's about to shoot!"
Rasconza flicked his favorite dagger high, catching it as it spun downward.
"Ho, ho! They can fire shafts all day. We're well out of range."
The arrow cut the air in a high arc, dipping to hit the ground far short of the wave brethren. Rasconza nudged a couple of rats.
"They ain't shooting to slay no beast. That's some kind of message.
Go and fetch it, mates. We'll see what Ublas has to say.
Rascanza read aloud the message written on a parchment attached to the arrow. The five ships you have are useless without rudders and tillers. I still hold the timber stock needed to repair them. At dawn tomorrow I will meet you where this arrow fell to earth. I will come alone, unarmed, ready to reach an agreement. My compliments to your skill as a leader and an adversary. I do not wish any further enmity to you. We will make peace and rule together. Ublas. Rascanza tied a red silken kerchief to a spear top and waved it back and forth, signaling agreement to the meeting. As he did so, he said to his captains,
"So, wants to talk peace, does he? Ha ha! I'd trust that'n like I'd trust you lot with a keg of grog. But never fear, buckos, I knows what Mad-Eyes is up to, and I'm ready."
Ublas tied his green silk kerchief to Sagatar's bow and waved heartily in reply, as he gave instructions to his chief trident rat.
"This time there will be no mistakes. You have your orders."
Sagatar averted her eyes from the mad hypnotic stare.
"Sire, your orders will be carried out."
The Pine Marten continued waving the kerchief, his voice laden with menace.
"Fail me this time, and your trident shall be fixed to the jetty, Sagatar, with your head mounted upon it."
40. It took quite some time for the abbot to muster up his courage and uncover his eyes. Lowering the blanket slowly, he peeped out at the head of Lask Frildur, protruding through the smashed panel of the cabin door. Durrell sat fascinated with horror, staring at the big lizard's head, until gradually the truth dawned upon him. There was no foul-smelling breath. The mouth was loosely open, and the reptilian eyes were glazed over, half-closed. Then the old mouse heard the drip-drip onto the floor, from a hideous slash beneath the scaly chin, right across the neck. The Monitor General was dead. Durrell began to shake all over, his frail body quivering with relief. Slowly he rose and ventured towards the door.
"Hello? Is any beast out there?" he called.
A low, hoarse voice answered.
"Ahoy, mouse. 'Tis your old messmate Romska. Open the door."
Fearfully the abbot shifted the table that had been wedging the door. Trying not to look at the slain monster, he unbarred the shutter, pulling inward. Hampered by the weight of the monitor, the door sagged open. Durrell hurried past the dead lizard, out onto the open deck. Romska sat with her back to the mast, a cutlass clutched loosely in her paws. With an effort she lifted her head and smiled weakly at the abbot.
"You ain't going to start calling me your child, are you?"
Durrell shook his head numbly, trying to ignore the scene of carnage around him. Dead beasts were draped everywhere on the silent ship as it plowed the watery wastes, from the masts, over the rails, and on the deck, from stem to stern. Waveworm resembled a floating slaughterhouse. Romska's head fell forward, and the cutlass slipped from her grasp, her voice half-chuckle, half-gurgle.
"Pretty, ain't it? There's only you and me left, Durrell."
Hurrying to the corsair's side, the abbot cradled her head, using the blanket he had brought with him as a pillow.
"Friend, you're hurt," he cried.
Romska's head lolled against Durrell's stained habit.
"Aye, that's the truth, bucko. But I fixed old Lask good and proper, didn't I? Ah, don't move me. There's only this mast holding my back together."
Durrell tried to glance over the ferret's shoulder at her back. She winced and shook her head slightly.
"Don't look. You don't want to see what that lizard's claws and fangs did to me, mate. Now listen careful, 'cause there ain't much time. Let go of me easy-like, and make your way to the tiller. She's still headed due west, so take a stern line and lash her steady. Go on, Father Abbot. Do like I say."
Making Romska as comfortable as possible, the old mouse eased himself away from her and scurried aft. Taking the stern rope, he tied it to one side of the gallery rail, looped it several times round the tiller, and tied the other end to the opposite rail, lashing the ship on course, due west. Then he went on a tour of the vessel, Stumbling over a slain monitor and two sea rats, he found glowing embers in the brazier in Lask's cabin. He added wood, lamp oil, and sea coal, and soon had a fire rekindled. First he put on some water to heat, then hunted around until he found an old canvas and some blankets. It was still drizzling lightly when he returned to Romska. She had dozed off. Durrell made a lean-to with the canvas and covered the Corsair Ferret with blankets to keep her warm. Then he resumed his search of the ship. Noon found the sky darkening. Bruised purple clouds hung over the oily, foamless swell of billows, and now the drizzle had turned to steady rain. It was still warm, though, and steam rose from Durrell's fur as he bustled out to Romska with food and drink. The Corsair opened her eyes feebly.
"You're a good creature, but an old fool. Take care of yourself. I ain't worth it. My string's played out."
Durrell cradled Romska's head as he ladled soup into her mouth.
"I'm afraid it's only dried fish and ship's biscuit with some water. But 'tis the best I could do, friend. You saved my life, and you were good to Viola, too. Without you, we would both have fallen victim to those lizards long ago. Drink up now."
Romska turned her mouth away from the ladle.
"Water. Just give us a drop of water, matey. I'm parched."
The abbot carefully guided a beaker to her mouth. Romska sipped the liquid and winked faintly at him.
"You hearken to me, Durrell. You could never sail this tub back to Mossflower. But she's bound you west, and with luck, you'll landfall at the Isle of San Petra. I've got mates there. Tell 'em you're my pal. 'Tis your only chance. Mayhap they'll help you."
Durrell stroked the Corsair's tattooed paw.
"Now, now, my child. None of that talk. You'll live to see your friends again. I'll make sure of it."
Romska smiled, her voice growing fainter as she replied,
"I hopes you make it back to Redwall Abbey some day. It looked like a nice place to be."
"Humph. You won't be bothered with types like me, then. Corsairs and sea rats and all manner of wave scum."
She shuddered, and Durrell drew the blanket up to her chin.
"Hush now, and rest, my child."
As Romska's eyes closed, she murmured drowsily,
"My child, I like that. Thank you, my father."
Her head lolled forward onto the Father Abbot of Redwall's paws for the last time. Durrell sat nursing the dead Corsair until it grew dark, heedless of the rain that soaked him as Waveworm sailed silently westward on the drifting swell with its lone cargo, one old mouse. Book 3. When Tears Are Shed. 41. Viola was wakened by the sounds of low voices nearby. It was Martin and Grath talking together. The logboat was almost stationary, bobbing in the warming dawn. Seaweed hawsers trailed limply along the boat's sides, and the seal folk were nowhere to be seen. Martin stood in the prow, staring up at a mountain that reared out of the ocean.
"Well, it's big enough," he said. "But it doesn't look like we can land anywhere. Why did the seal folk slide off and leave us here, I wonder? It's naught but a mountain thrusting up out of the water."
Grath was as puzzled as the mouse warrior.
"Maybe there's something or some beast here they wanted us to see. Let's use these broken struts and oars and paddle o'er there."
Plog poked his head from under the canvas awning.
"Whoa, I'm stiff as a board. Where are we?"
Welko thrust his head up alongside that of his brother, grinning.
"Nice and warm, though," he said. "Looks like it's going to be sunny. I'm starving. Is that old cookie awake yet?"
A long paw reached out and cuffed the shrew's ear.
"Old cookie, indeed, you graceless scruff-furred wretch.
Aye, sir, I'm Clextar Lepus Montissel of the far northern Montissels, don't you know? And furthermore, young feller, my lad, I don't well appreciate foul young blots like yourself snoring down my delicate ears all night. As for breakfast, afraid you'll have to whistle for it. Clean out of grub, we are, what?"
Viola shook her head in disgust.
Well, there's a fine thing. Those seals sliding off without so much as a by your leave. And us without a bite of food, floating around goodness knows where, with nothing to show for it but a hulking great mountain shoving itself out of the water.
Grath could not help smiling at the complaining bull maid. Well, tut, tut, missy. Grab a cob of wood and start paddling. We won't talk ourselves out of this fix, that's for sure.
The rock was massive, smooth-sided, high and impregnable, and there was no discernible opening in it. They paddled most of the day, skirting the stone monolith, searching for a place to land, but the quest seemed fruitless. Sometime around mid-afternoon, they stopped to rest, sweltering under a hot sun. Klecki gazed longingly at the clear blue sea.
Looks wonderful, don't it? I say, chaps, if I don't get something soon to wet my jolly old lips, I might try a drink of that.
I wouldn't recommend it. Sea water can be nasty stuff.
Klecki nearly fell overboard with shock. A young female otter had slid gracefully into the logboat and was sitting beside him.
Who the flippin' heck are you, miss? And where's your manners?
Jolly well near scared two seasons' growth out of me ears.
Poppin' up like that.
Kindly don't do it again. Bad form, what? The little otter maid smiled prettily, twitching her nose at them.
Beg your puddin', sir. But what are you? You're not an otter.
Humph. I should say not, Miguel. I'm a hare, actually. Name's Klecki.
Pleased to meet you, Mr. Klecki. I'm Winnigold, of the Holt of Walliam Rudderwake. I spect the Hom and his seal folk brought you here to see us.
Klecki twitched his ears rather irately.
Chaw! Well, if he did, he never said anything to us about it. Blinkin' fella should say where he's taken a chap, instead of all this homin' and harrin'. What?
Excuse me, Martin interrupted. But if you two could break off this pleasant conversation long enough, perhaps you, miss, could show us to the Holt of your father, Walliam Rudderwake.
Realization suddenly struck Flog. The seals were saying Whalum.
Maybe that's cause they couldn't say Walliam properly.
Klecki absent-mindedly cuffed Plog's ear.
Huh, I know that. Seal language. Speak it perfectly, old chap, perfectly.
I think friend Martin's right, though, missy. You'd better take us to your dear old pater, what?
Winnigold directed them to take the logboat further round the side of the rock. A cable made from twined seaweed and kelp hung from a niche carved into the rock. It trailed away into the sea like a great thick serpent. The little otter maid unhooked the cable, and passing it to Grath, she explained its purpose.
Look down into the water. What do you see?
Grath stared downward into the clear depths. There's a hole, like some sort of tunnel in the mountain, right near the surface here. The cable goes into it.
Winnigold lowered her voice, as if revealing a secret.
If we wait, the sea will lower itself, and the tunnel will appear in front of us. My father says it is the trough between every 19th and 20th wave that washes against the east side of our mountain. Suddenly the sea level will sink and expose the cave mouth. If we all lie flat in your boat and heave on the cable, we can pull ourselves through to the inner island.
Viola leaned over the boat's edge, gazing at the great hole in the rock fearfully.
But it's under water, she cried. We'll all be drowned. I'm scared.
Winnigold giggled at the timid bull maid.
Silly, there's no need to be feared, you'll see.
I haven't been counting the waves, but I think it's best we all lie down.
Without warning, a wave lapped high, sending the boat up on its crest. Then it dropped sharply. There was a swoosh, as if some gigantic monster had exhaled, and they were looking straight into the mouth of the tunnel, wide and dark and dripping seawater, directly in front of them.
"Get down, mates, lie flat!"
Winnigold yelled. She gave a mighty heave on the cable, and the logboat shot into the opening, like a tiny fish into the mouth of a whale. They were surrounded by an eerie blue light, shimmering from the tunnel walls. The logboat rose, stopping no more than a paw's length from the shell-encrusted tunnel ceiling. As Winnigold tugged on the cable, their vessel shot forward, and the entire logboat crew seized hold of the thick kelp and seawater hawser, and, lying flat on their backs, began pulling. The little craft sped along inside the tunnel. Limpets, barnacles, shells, and hanging fronds
almost scraped the prow of the boat, and great crabs scuttled about in the bluish light above their faces. The transition from sudden bright tropical sunlight to aquamarine dimness caused golden sunbursts upon their vision whenever they blinked. It was the oddest of experiences. Suddenly it was bright hot daylight again. Still holding the cable, they stood up slowly and gazed awestruck at the scene surrounding them. Where the cable ended, it was made fast to a tree stump on the banks of a broad stream. Fields stretched about the entire area, ending in trees, which gave way to dense vegetation and shrubbery, climbing the mountain's inner slopes. Martin turned full circle, staring up at the high circular rock rim. It's like some kind of a massive crater, as if the mountain had had the heart taken out of it. We're in a big basin. Cupping both paws to her mouth, Winnie Gold cried out, setting echoes bouncing and ringing from the surrounding heights.
Rudd awake!
Otters came bounding from everywhere, dashing across the fields, tumbling down the banks, and popping from the stream's surface. They crowded around the logboat, staring silently at the newcomers. Every beast, male and female, even the babes, was fully armed. Slings, clubs, and javelins were much in evidence. Then a murmur ran through the ranks as they parted. A magnificent male otter, fully a head taller than the rest, strode purposefully forward. His fur was dark, almost sable, and he was forbiddingly muscled through his sleek neck and broad shoulders. Grath stared curiously at the big bow he carried, a shaft set ready upon its bowstring. Over his shoulder she could see a quiverful of red-feathered arrows. He glanced down from the top of the bank, noting that she also carried a bow and arrows. Then he nodded and stood to one side. From behind the big otter, another appeared, old and gray, but radiating a presence of wisdom and calm. The old otter carried an oak staff, and was garbed in a long homespun tunic of light brown color. His voice was deep and warm.
"Do you come to Ruddering in peace? Are you friends?"
Martin realized who the patriarchal-looking beast was. Leaving the boat, he waded ashore, and, bowing low, placed his sword on the ground in front of the old otter.
"Peace be upon you, Walliam Rudderwake, and all of your holt. I am Martin the Warrior of Redwall Abbey. The Halm of Sealfolk delivered us to your island. We are friends."
Walliam's grizzled features creased into a gentle smile. He nodded to Grath.
"Which holt come you from?"
Grath inclined her head to one side, allowing her rudder to rise and tip beneath her chin in a courtly old-fashioned gesture.
"I am Grath Longfletch of Holt Lutra, sire."
Walliam appeared extremely gratified by Grath's politeness.
"Well said, maiden. It is a long time since I saw such courtesy in an otter. Would that half of my holt had your good manners. You and your friends look as if food would do you no harm. Come, I always find conversation far more pleasant over a good meal. Inbar, will you carry our friend Grath's bow and arrows for her?"
Walliam's huge, dark-furred son leapt forward willingly, missing the smile that passed between his father and Martin. The old otter picked up the warrior mouse's sword.
"I will carry this for you. 'Tis a blade that I have only once seen the like of. The sword of a great warrior, ancient and beautiful."
Helped by numerous otters, the friends set out along the stream bank to Holt Rudderwake. 42. The Holt was a sprawling, comfortable cave in the mountainside, next to where the stream source bubbled from the rocks. Thick woven rush mats and rock slabs for tables were the only furniture. A fire was kept under an oven made of baked clay and stone. The otters were partial to great soups and stews of seaweed and shellfish. Also much in favor, owing to the tropical and fertile nature of their island, were magnificent fruit salads. As they ate, Martin related their story to Walliam and his wife, a great fat old grandma otter called Doramee, who seemed always to be surrounded by grandbabes climbing over her and swinging on her apron strings. Walliam listened carefully to Martin's narrative, as did several of the Holt elders. Klecky was the center of attention with the rest of the otters. His ever-present appetite for staggering amounts of food astounded them. The hare declined shellfish, but did justice to everything else. "Can't abide the old edible mollusks, what?" he announced. "Cockles and mussels and all that. Bring me out and an itchy paw rash, chaps. Sorry. Oh, I say, you fellers, this big ball tastes rather splendid." The otters hooted with laughter. "'Tain't a ball, mate. That's a melon. You're not supposed to eat the seeds, though." "Oh, I dunno. Tastes pretty good to me. Excuse me, old chap. Do you mind not hogging that seaweed soup? Nice salty taste. Sort of contrasts jolly well with these peach thingies. Ouch! My word! You could use these stones to chuck from your slings, great lumpy things. You there, otter chap, have the decency to unstone that big peach for a feller, will you? That's the style." Enbar was admiring Grat's bow and arrows. "Nice string, well twined. I don't know which has the stronger pull, your bow or mine. Our arrows are the same length, too." Grath closed one eye, sighting down the shaft of one of Enbar's red-feathered arrows. "Good and straight. They'd fly true." The normally taciturn otter tested an arrow point on his paw. "That's my full name, Enbar Trueflight. I'll show you where I usually practice. Maybe we can loose off a few shafts together." Grath agreed, a hint of challenge in her smile. "I'd like to do that, Enbar. We'll match each other arrow for arrow after we've eaten." Walliam's wife, Doromi, was speaking to Martin, whilst her husband took the little otters off to watch Clecky. The babes had never seen a hare before. "Our holt of Rudderwakes lived on this isle I don't know how long. It goes right back into the mists of time. There's some say that it were four otter families who escaped from a corsair vessel and found their way to this place purely by accident. Anyway, Martin, our ancestors made Ruddering Isle their own. They found a great battle with the lizards that used to live here. What lizards they didn't slay were driven off to another isle way west of here. Mayhap 'tis that San Petra place you talk of. That was more seasons ago than a score of otters could count. Ruddering Isle is our home now. Sea rats and corsairs passing in their ships don't even know this is an island. To them, 'tis just a mountain poking up out of the ocean with no place to land upon. No beast knows we're living here, except in the seals and you and your friends, Martin. Swear, if ever you leave here, not to tell a living creature of our isle." The warrior mouse patted Doromi's paw. "I swear it will be so. I'd hate to think of me or my crew being the cause of ever bringing unwelcome visitors here to your beautiful home." Viola, Plog, and Welko were trying to learn an otter dance. They found it very difficult, not having the balance that an otter's rudder-like tail affords. Winnie-Gold and her chums were whirling and wheeling about, balancing first on one foot paw, then hopping onto the other, with a skillful tailspin between each leap. A deep-voiced old otter wife beat two drums with her tail as she sang for the dancers. "Ho, comb your whiskers, brush that tail, place a flower behind your ear, wash those paws in my old pail, we're off a-dancin', dear. Ooh! Paws up high, rudder on the deck, pace up to your partner, check. Rudder in the air, paws on the ground, whirl that otter round and round. Vittles on a table, drinks there too, hear the music playin'. Smile at me, I'll dance with you, every otter sayin', ooh! Shuffle back and clap both paws. I'll clap mine and you clap yours. Turn away now, back to back. Slap those tails down, whack, whack, whack." Giggling and laughing, they fell to the floor exhausted. Clecky looked up from a wild grape trifle, shaking his head. "Do yourself a mischief, prancing about like that after eatin'. Don't you chaps know any good slow ballads to settle the jolly old digestion?" He was immediately beset by several young otters. "Sing for us, Mr. Clecky. Oh, please do, sir." Finishing his trifle in two great gulps, the hare was up on his paws, ready to sing, but denying it strenuously. "Oh, have a heart, you young rips. I haven't twiddled the old vocal cords in an absolute age, don't you know?" "Now to sing," old Walliam remonstrated. The hare took the center of the floor as if he had not heard Walliam's remark. "Oh, well, if you insist, I'll just do one. A very bad salad. Sad ballad.
Right, here goes, Chavs. Drooping his whiskers and quivering his ears in a most pathetic manner, he clasped both paws and stared soulfully at his audience. This is the story of Corkle Hare, which is most terribly tragic, horribly sad, and pretty awfully fearful. So pray give attention, list to my song, and don't fall asleep, although 'tis not too cheerful. Poor Corkle fell foul of an evil fox, who was mean and horribly cruel, and foolishly he challenged him next morning at dawn to a duel. Here Clecky paused and glared at Plog and Welko. Either of you rogues spit another melon seed at me, and I'll kick your little fat tails halfway up yonder mountain. Ahem! Beg pardon for the untimely interruption, chaps. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. Both creatures chose as their weapons to hurl at each other salad. Good job they never chose soup, or else I might never have wrote this ballad. So the very next morning, as dawn did break, all bright and hot and warm and sunny, which, considering it was the dead of winter, our hero did not find too funny. Clucky jumped and clapped a paw to his tail, glaring at Plog and Welko, who were sitting looking the pictures of innocence. "Just one more melon seed, you rotters, just one more!" He continued his elongated recitation. There in the field the two creatures met, each beast with salad laden. A terrible sight not fit for the eyes of any tender young maiden. And the lettuce and the carrots and the onions, they all flew like lightning. And they fought and they ate and they fought. The scene was pretty frightening. Clecky twitched his nose as a melon seed bounced off it. He narrowed his eyes and pointed vehemently at the two shrews. Right, that's it. Soon as I'm finished this heart-rending ditty, you two are in for it. He finished the song at top speed, as if it were a fast jig. But now, my friends, I've reached the end of my most sad rendition. At the end of the epic battle royal, this was the sad position. Neither the fox nor the hare had won. They were both in bad condition, suffering from fierce indigestion, because they'd ate all the ammunition. With a bound he was away after the two shrews, who shot off like sardines with a shark on their tails. The audience fell about laughing helplessly. Doramy held her tubby sides, shaking with mirth. "Oh, ho, 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 hoo, hoo! That'll teach him to spit melon pips at him!" Viola and Winnigold were chuckling so hard that tears coursed down their cheeks as they confessed. "Hee, hee! It wasn't hee-hee Plog or ha-ha-ha Welko spittin' those pips. Hoo, hoo, hoo! It was us! Hee-ha-ha-hee-ho-ho-ho!"
William Rudderwake and his otters were excellent hosts to the first land visitors they had ever received. Entertainment, singing, eating, drinking, and dancing went on far into the night, only stopping because every beast was totally exhausted. Interspersed with the weary logboat crew, otters slept where they fell, everywhere about the cave. Babes, youngsters, and parents lay draped over rocks or curled on rush mats in a tangle of paws and tails. William sat in the light of the oven fire. He and Martin were the only two left awake. The otter patriarch stared piercingly at the warrior mouse, until eventually Martin felt he had to speak and break the silence. "Tell me, William, how did you come to know the seal folk?" The otter shifted his gaze to the fire and shrugged. "We have always known them. My father and his father before him treated the seals, bulls, wives, and pups, for injuries and ailments. So it has fallen to my lot now. I am their healer. Halm and his followers have great respect for the Holt of Rudderwake. They would do anything for us. Lucky 'twas that you had an otter in your crew, or they might never have brought you to my island." That seemed as much information as William was willing to impart. Silence fell on the two creatures as they sat together in the soft tropic night, staring into the ash-surrounded embers burning low beneath the oven.
Martin felt slightly uneasy in the presence of Walliam. From the corner of his eye, he noted the otter had transferred his gaze from the fire. Hairs on the back of the warrior mouse's neck began to prickle. He turned suddenly and locked eyes with Walliam's piercing stare. "Friend, is there something you are hiding from me?" Rising slowly, Walliam beckoned Martin to follow him. "Let us walk together in the moonlight," he said. In the limited view of sky surrounded by the high mountainous crater, a summer moon hung like a pale gold coin, shedding its light on the two figures strolling through lush grasses toward the stream bank. Walliam Rudderwake spoke when they were out of hearing from the cave. "Hearken to me, Martin of Redwall. I have things to tell you, things that I could tell to no other beast, lest they think I am growing feeble in the brain. Would it surprise you to know that I already knew your face, that I had seen you long before you came to this island?" The warrior mouse sat down on the stream bank. "It would surprise me greatly. Tell me more, Walliam." Leaning on Martin's shoulder, the old otter lowered himself to sit upon the bank. He tossed a twig into the stream and watched the water bear it away to the seas. "3 moons ago, I had a dream. That was when you appeared in my mind. But was it you, or one who looked just like you? It was a mouse, a warrior like yourself. When you arrived at my island today, I knew then it was you. You were not wearing armor like the mouse in my dream, but your face was the same as his, and the sword you carried was the same wonderful blade. I knew this for certain when I picked up that sword to carry it for you. I could feel it in the hilt and the blade." Martin nodded, understanding beginning to dawn on him. Walliam had been visited in his dream by the first Martin of long ago. "Did the mouse speak words to you, friend? Was there a message?" In the darkness, the otter's eyes opened wide with surprise. "Yes, he did. I felt a great calm come over me. His voice sounded like a distant bell, echoing, warm." End of Side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.